This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 29th of June, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And in today's episode, we're talking with John Holcroft in an interview I recorded with him earlier on this week. Now, if you've ever had a business or social enterprise idea, and if you've asked people about your idea, they might have either said, yes, that's absolutely wonderful, because they love you and care about you, or they might have been negative. But how do you actually validate your business ideas and get a really true and genuine response from people? Well, that's what John tells us all about. He's developed apps for hospitals and the NHS. He's won awards for advancing patient safety, but his advice is applicable to all new businesses and ideas too. So in this wide-ranging interview, you'll learn ever such a lot about testing your business or social enterprise ideas. I hope you really enjoy the interview, and we'll go straight into it right now.
We're open for business live.
So hi there, John. Thanks so much for joining me today. Can you introduce yourself? Tell me a bit about you, who you are and what you do.
Oh, hi, Jamie. I'm John Holcroft. The simplest explanation of what I do is to say I'm an app developer, but I like things a bit more than that. I'm really into product development, and I particularly love doing things in the NHS and for healthcare. Apps which make a difference,
right,
is where I'm at.
Great. Apps which make a difference. So what sort of apps, what do they do? Do they help patients, and how do they do it?
Mine have been primarily for doctors.
Okay.
To give an example, my wife's a doctor, and actually I've good networks with doctors. And through this, I find, when my wife first became a junior doctor, I realized that it's really quite a struggle for them. It's a hard life being a junior doctor in a hospital. And lots of problems and complaints my wife was coming with, I thought, actually, technology can help there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, so I'll talk about the first app I did for hospital, which actually won an award for advancing patient safety. So I'm quite pleased with it. And it was of a quite basic idea, which is that if you're in a hospital, the people who are going to see you and treat you, the people you're encountering mostly, are the junior doctors. So the people who are actually new, they've probably only been in that department up to 4 months. Mm-hmm. And though they, of course, have been in medical school and know their things, they don't necessarily know the specifics of that department. And whereas to the consultants, everything you or I might come in with is normal. It's the usual thing that you treat in the usual way.
Yes.
To the new doctors, they don't know what the usual things are and what the usual tests are and what is usual. And so I was hearing stories from doctors about that, doing, they were working overnight and on their own and didn't know what to do.
Okay.
And it's kind of, because hospitals have clinical guidelines which are supposed to hold this information, but it's not really very accessible because, first of all, you have to know it exists, which lots of doctors didn't. And it's on intranet, which, so they say, you can get to via 19 easy clicks. And also that you have to, there's even a problem getting to computers in a hospital because you have to go to a computer at the nurse's station, and if someone might be using it, what can you do? So in terms of the doctors trying to get the information they need, it's quite challenging. So I worked with my local hospital here, which is Frimley Park Hospital, though it's now used in other places. And we were making the guide for the junior doctors, starting with the common and emergency conditions. And it was all about giving them really incredibly fast access to the information they needed at the time they were treating patients.
Okay, grand. Right, so giving access to information when it's needed, because data and access to data is a massive issue in the NHS, isn't it?
I think, looking at the NHS, I'm not a doctor, I don't actually work in the NHS, but the more I see of hospitals, the more I see that all of their issues, or lots of their issues, are related to communication. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's all about getting information from one person to another, just sharing knowledge, and even across patients, across doctors, it's all communication issues.
Right, grand. So you developed your app, and it, well, I hesitate to say makes doctors' lives easier. It's somewhat more crucial and vital than that, and one of your apps has won an award for advancing patients'
safety. You have made it sound like you simply got on and did this. But what was the iterative process behind coming up with the idea for the app, the understanding that there was a need, as you've described really succinctly and clearly there, and actually taking the app from concept to rolling it out and making it available for people?
Well, that's the interesting thing about app development. I think it's actually true for all product development. Is it's actually the first step is getting in sync with your users. Because I had ideas of what, my first ideas of what would be useful were wrong. I think it's true of almost everyone's first business idea. You have identified a problem correctly, but your first idea for solving it is often not right. And the way you get it right, of course, is just by talking to people. So I was there, I started this project by actually talking to the doctors and getting them to tell me their stories of what their experience was on the ward and what their challenges were. Right. And then through that, as you understand their challenges, that's where you start to understand what it is you could make that could help that.
So, yes, yeah, sorry, and I interrupted you there, but so it was really getting to grips with a problem that those doctors on the wards are facing. So talking with them and hearing from them, asking them questions, and only once you could understand what those problems were, those challenges were, could you make sure that your idea would address them.
Indeed, because I had a previous startup. I used to have a very well-paid job in the city writing software for investment banks.
Right.
But I left that to do, because actually I didn't believe it was important, and actually started doing a music education startup all to help kids learn to play pieces on the piano.
Oh, really?
I saw there was a problem, which is, I noticed that my kids were having trouble to practice, and they had started very keen and then were looking to give up. And it was a problem for everyone, which is all this standard idea of going to lessons every week. It fails almost everyone. Almost everyone you talk to says, oh yeah, we did that. Then I gave up. I wish I hadn't. And all the kids are doing, it seems to be just a churn of process of people doing music lessons and then giving up. And I was trying to work out why. Anyway, so that's why I left my day job and started doing that.
So you started doing that, and how did that go then? Because that sounds like a really interesting concept and idea.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. But as a product, it didn't work. Well, it did work, and it didn't. It worked as a product, but failed as a business.
Right, and so taught you a few things there.
Absolutely. For a start, I should have given up sooner, but that's a standard flaw with all entrepreneurs. Your first business idea, you're loath to move on. But it was a good thing, because I did sorts of this problem. I did a ton of research, find out all about the music on the theory of learning and doing things, and someone was at. I did that, and I made a product that really properly worked. The users who used it were saying it was like learning on steroids. Yeah. Like it felt easy, and all of a sudden they could learn these pieces for their piano as it was very quickly. Mm-hmm. But the reason it failed is I had missed a point right at the start, which is that I hadn't paid attention to my market in terms of my product helped kids learning to play the piano. It would solve the problem of why they would get frustrated and why they would give up.
Yeah.
But they didn't buy it. Their parents did. And their parents bought it based on a recommendation from a music teacher.
Uh-huh.
And people are going to look for a product if they know there's a problem. Yeah. And though I knew there was a problem, that all these kids were likely to give up their instrument, everyone who's currently in the process doesn't yet know that they're on this path to failure.
No.
Because the way that most this is me having a bit of a rant about music teachers, they're lovely people, but the process that most of them go through works for very few people. And those very few people it works for become music teachers. And they just repeat the cycle of the same thing, which kind of demotivates people and other people giving up. So in terms of the market, I was kind of screwed. In hindsight, I realized this, that, all right, it might have been brilliant, but the market I was going for, which was, you know, the graded piano exams type things, all that sort of stuff, the people in it don't realize I've got a problem, so it's going to be very hard to sell them a product.
Yes, I can see that. Absolutely. That makes sense. So you learned from that and you closed that business. Had you already had the idea for the patient safety app for the app to support doctors and to give them the access to the knowledge that they needed when they needed it, when you closed this the music?
To be honest, I was exploring ideas.
Right.
I was sort of throwing things at the wall and seeing what would stick.
Yep.
So I was looking for problems that mattered and seeing what could help. So that was one of the first things I did. And also just to earn some money, I went to work for Marks and Spencer's and worked on their shopping app, which was tremendous training because they have fantastic user experience labs. And I got to see how, you know, big companies do this thing with all the professional designers and everyone else, which I could then use later on times, which is also something I'll talk to you about in a moment, possibly. And then as I was going through this, I also did things. I went to NHS Hack Days. These things where you get groups of doctors together and techies. Yes. And the doctors pitch ideas for things where technology could help. And then over a weekend, you try to make something. And I actually met a doctor through that. And we actually formed a startup, which we went through a startup accelerator with, a tech for good startup accelerator called Bethnal Green Ventures.
Right.
So we got some funding from them and we made our main product with them.
Super. So you met this doctor at the Hackaday and you set up a company, you got funding from the accelerator, Bethnal Green Ventures, and presumably mentoring support as well as funding. And how did that business then progress?
Oh, it was very interesting because the product, just a very brief description of what the product was, which is that doctors have to use a thing called an otoscope. That's the thing the doctors use to look in your ear.
Right.
Now, it's very easy for doctors to learn to use that to look in an ear, but it's very hard for them to learn to diagnose conditions by seeing what they're through. Because if they look in their friend's ears are normal. And what they see is they look through this and they get this little porthole, like tiny view, and they got to move around trying to make a picture of the inside of an ear and then do things. So this was all about on a phone using the attitude sensor. So as you held the phone and moved it around, you would change the view as if you were looking through this otoscope inside an ear.
Yeah.
So it would be a great doctor's training tool. And we made that, a proof of concept at the Hack Day. We looked and see if we could make that into a product. So we entered did the pitch and the various things to get in to the Startup Accelerator. And they're, of course, doing lots of training and mentoring. And then we kind of like stepped back, which is in some ways, I think that was backward in terms of we made a product so early, but I think actually it was quite good in terms of it was what I would call a spike. We were proving that an idea could work even if it wasn't yet the full product, which was more of a proof that the technology could exist. And then we went to, actually, when we were in the Startup Accelerator, we're trying to find a market for it.
Yeah.
And that's what we started to do, properly honing my product research and interviewing skills.
Because
it turns out there's good and bad questions you can ask and good and bad ways to talk people about your ideas. And so my old music startup, I did it the appalling way. There's an appalling way to talk to people about your idea. and that's to talk to your family and friends, and you talk at them for 20 to 30 minutes explaining the problem. You explain that, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this, and nothing on a thought of this, and oh, there's this problem, and it's wrong for all these reasons. And you just talk at people for ages.
Right.
And that's
what do they do? what happens then?
Well, you get one of two answers, right? You get, oh, well, that's very nice. Yeah, oh, I can see that would be great. Yeah, kind of, you go girl type responses, moving stuff, which sounds nice, but isn't actually any help. Or you get, some people, it's always very surprising when you get it, which is the, ooh, are you sure? Isn't that a bit risky? Are you the right person to be making this? Surely it's already been made, and you're not an expert in that. which is really, actually, when people do that, it's actually they're voicing their own concerns. It's the reason why they would be scared to do it. Right. Still doesn't help.
That is a very good point. They're voicing their fears, not why you shouldn't do it. So if they're being negative or expressing risks, Or, as he said before, they're saying, oh, yes, that's wonderful. Blind encouragement, perhaps, because that you are someone they care about, that you're their friend or their family member. And so they're merrily going, yes, wonderful, but they're not the people who will be buying it. From
exactly. So they actually don't really tell you anything useful about the product. They might motivate you or demotivate you, but it doesn't really matter. So I wonder, I do want to answer one question there, because when you hear this stuff, it's a thing that everyone thinks when they start something. They wonder, am I the right person to be doing this? Because nobody has everything you need together, right? So for my doctors that I work with are doctors and I am not. So why should I do a medical app? Because I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert in the medical field. Who am I to do a medical app if I'm not a doctor? But similarly, who's a doctor to do a medical app? He's not a developer. He's not a product expert. He knows about treating patients. He's not, he or she is not the right person to make a product. So everyone's got the imposter syndrome that I'm possibly not the right person to do this. We just have to work through it. If you've got the idea and you're prepared to execute, you're the right person to do it. Anyway, but the people you want to talk to are the people who are actually doing the thing.
Yes.
I think let's give a great example, because I think I've done this just really well quite recently for Medway Hospital in Kent. They were looking at issues they had with communication between midwives and the doctors. So this is all largely neonatal babies being born issues. And what happens is that generally the midwives are doing everything, but at various points they will have a concern about a baby that they will want a doctor to check out on. And the bad old system is that they would, because they use these things called bleeps, which are pagers, as all of us thought died out in the 90s, but are still used in hospitals, a midwife would bleep a doctor who then gets interrupted in what they're doing, has to go find a phone, ring the number which came up on their pager. Someone then answers and then tells them, come to room 5. And I imagine this is actually just not good for anyone. It takes a huge amount of time, and they don't have any information to know what they're coming into.
No, it doesn't sound at all like a very efficient process.
Believe it or not, that's almost the entire NHS. if they could fix that problem, it would be like having 3,000 extra doctors.
Indeed.
Anyway, but that's me having my little rant on that bit. Issues, they want to get more information to the doctors, and the consultant got in touch with me because I'd done this kind of guidelines app for their hospital earlier and gone very well. But they had an idea for this app of, oh yeah, we'll do this kind of one screen thing, kind of risk scoring. They put in midwife and information, it comes up with a score for how risky the situation is. And I looked at this and thought, not very convinced, but I'll listen to people and talk to them. And so what I then did was I found out, well, who are the people who matter to actually making this thing happen?
Yeah.
In this case, that would be, well, primarily the midwives, who are the people who are going to be using the system, the junior doctors they're going to be communicating with, the senior doctors who get issues get escalated to, and also the IT department in the hospital, the people who have to look after and manage any computer systems which happen. And so I went through and I organized interviews with all these people, and rather than telling them my idea and what I thought should happen, I instead got them to tell me stories. I got them to tell me about, you know, what are some of the pain points that's happening, and got them to tell me, yeah, got to explain. I said, all right, so it's like I was talking to a midwife, saying, oh, what happens when you have an issue? What's the actual process you go through? Just talk me through it. And they would explain that, and then, you know, and they would, if you keep talking for a while, they'll explain, you know, how it feels and the actions and the issues they have. And again, they would go and talk to the junior doctors. Mm-hmm. And even there, ask them certain questions, you know, like, no, I even ask them certain points, because, you know, what scares you? And they would explain situations. I know that what scares them is that they get this call to come to room 5. They come in and they see it's an emergency. And that all of a sudden, they're now got two problems, which is they have an emergency to deal with and an emergency they need to escalate to their senior support.
Right. Okay.
Whereas if they would have known beforehand, they could have, you know, escalated it whilst they were going towards the situation to deal with.
Indeed, yes.
And of course, the IT people were saying all about all the pros and cons of all the various systems, and in particular where they're looking to go, where the future of the IT in the hospital they envisage. So using all of these things together, that then allowed me to actually develop a product idea for that. Actually, you know, that your main problems about communication, it is actually scoring the risk isn't actually that relevant. It's actually just getting the information from these midwives, the doctors, and letting everyone have visibility over it, and making sure, and also giving the midwives the ability to know that people are on the way and dealing with it. And yes. So anyway, that's kind of thing, example of just where you, because after you as a product designer have to design the product. I can't expect the doctors or the midwives to design the perfect app for doing this. That's my job, you know, but I will listen to all of them because no one of them has the entire story. You know, the consultant couldn't design this thing, nor the junior doctor, nor the midwife. You've got to take all their stories and concerns and try to get to the essence of what their issues are and see what you can do around that.
Right, absolutely. So that's a great example of how you do that and getting to the essence, getting to their stories. So that is entirely applicable to anyone designing any other product, any other app, any other product, this process. And it's a much better way than simply talking at someone, as you described earlier, for 20 or 30 minutes about problems that you believe exist, and getting people to agree with you or say it sounds great or say it sounds risky. This is an interview process where you're asking people about their fears, their frustrations, their problems, asking them to describe them. So, and you've shown how it worked.
Indeed, the only I'll explain just I'll tell you how to know it's going well or badly.
Yes.
And also some gotchas. So gotchas are only listening to the domain expert. For instance, the consultant got in touch with me.
Sorry, John, to interrupt. Can you just say that again? Only listening to the
domain expert.
Right.
So in this case, the consultant. Say this, I was in this medical lab. The consultant got in touch, who obviously is an expert in babies being delivered and their hospital.
Yeah.
But if I would have only listened to them, I would have made the wrong thing.
Right.
Because I only had part of the picture. Similarly, if I would have only talked to piano teachers in my old music teaching app, they wouldn't have understood actually the what the experience was of actually the kids and the parents are of trying to learn the piano. You got to talk to everyone. Like signs, there's some like gotchas. How to know if you end a meeting,
yeah,
and you went, "Ooh, that went really well. We're getting lots of positive feedback." That's a giant red flag. That didn't go well. Right. Also, if you're doing all the talking, it's not going well. You should be going to get them to talk as much as you can whilst it's still sounding like a real conversation. So I like to always start these kind of things just by actually chatting to people. If someone says, "I've just come back from holiday," I'll talk about their holiday. And, you just have a nice normal conversation about things. You're trying to make it like a normal conversation where you're interested in their lives, that you're just really interested in them and how everything day to day works for them.
Right. So folk can be very poor listeners, can't they? And can just have a tendency to go and talk at people. And if you're getting people nodding blindly at you in terms of nodding in agreement, or giving you what sounds on the surface like positive feedback, but it is actually quite superficial, rather than asking you questions and rather than you listening to them, it really isn't going well. So giant red flag. If you're sitting there thinking, everyone's nodding, this is going well, you're not actually listening to people.
No, that's it. Because everyone fundamentally really is polite. They want you to feel good. You know, they want you to see to be nice. The only time you're, and to a certain extent, in many cases, they're actually therefore lying to you. They're just saying the nice thing to make you feel good, and or maybe to get you to go away. But what people can't lie about is telling you a story, is telling you some of their real experiences. That always gets the truth.
That is such a great tip for people testing a business idea. That is really, really crucial stuff. So thanks for that, John. Now, you mentioned...
I'll tell you something I like to end with, because if I end an interview, and this is a trick I learned, but there's a great book. If you want to learn more about this stuff, there's a great book called The Mom Test. David Fitzgerald, I think.
Do you know, it's been mentioned on this radio show two or three times in the past, and Laura Bennett, who's been on the programme several times, actually, she went to mentor a whole load of startups in Gaza a couple of years ago, and she shipped out there several copies, well, so tens of copies of the Mom Test to give to people as well. And she's been on the program raving about how helpful the book is. Lovely to hear another endorsement of the book from you there, John. That's
indeed. So if you want to know more about talking to people to find out about your product ideas, the Mom Test is the book. Yeah. Let me talk about then. Even though I said it so highly, let's talk about the negatives, which are that when you talk to people about your idea, what you what you're really trying to get to is yes. So you would love to get these four things together, right? You'd love to find someone who has the problem that you've got, that know they have the problem, have the budget to solve the problem, and really are already cobbling together a solution. They're trying to make do with something, right? That would be brilliant if they got all that. If you've got all those four things, you're on to a winner. Sometimes you don't, but if you don't get all the things, that's not necessarily means it's a disaster, it just means it's going to be harder work.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, my music education startup at the beginning, right? Do people have the problem? Well, yeah, there was lots of these kids and families have the problems of they're about to have lots of issues learning to play the piano.
Yeah.
Do they know they have the problem? No, they do not know they have a problem. Have they probably solved the problem? Well, yeah, they probably would have spent some money on it. And are they cobbling together a makeshift solution? Not really. You know, that was two or three. I could have possibly done better by, say, educating people that, you know, here's this disaster which is coming along the way. It might have helped. Or I think more likely I would have had some more success. If I would have gone to adults who had previously failed as children to learn an instrument, then I would have got somewhere. You know, they know they've got a problem with motivation and practice, and they know they do. You know, it would have been different. Talk less to why the last one, because that... have already cobbled together their own makeshift solution. Because that's getting a bad answer to that is actually why we stopped our startup. We didn't proceed after the startup accelerator.
Right.
Because after spending so much money in my first startup and not giving up until really I actually had to give up.
Yeah.
I was prepared to try again, but I was also prepared to move on if it wasn't working.
Nice.
And the point where I decided to move on was that this Otoscope simulator was great. It worked. Like my 10-year-old son, man, said, learned to diagnose ear conditions in like 3 or 4 minutes. And it was really cool. But who needs it? And we thought, all right, well, what's the market for it? Can we find them? I thought, well, who needs to look into ears? Well, it's GPs. GPs are using the stuff day in, day out, right? But they actually aren't really trained. You know, when they were medical school, they had like a couple of days doing the stuff years ago. And the only people who are really, really good at doing them are the people who did when doctors first train, they have to spend a couple of years in hospitals going through all the various departments.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat random which departments they'll go through. There's some core ones, but there's lots of others which they may or may not do. Now, one of the ones they may or may not do is the ear, nose, and throat. So any GP who had gone through the ear, nose, and throat department was an expert. Like, they were absolutely wonderful at using these otoscopes.
Right.
But that's only like 1 in 10 of GPs, really. The other 9 out of 10 were just cobbling it together. So, GPs, where we should go, that's who we should find. So we talked to GPs. And we asked them, how do you find your otoscope skills? And they go, oh, yes, awful. I just bounce everything. Unless it's like the easy ones, I just refer it to the hospital. Just pass it on up. And so... They had a problem and they knew they had the problem. But then we asked the question, all right, so all right, you know you've got this problem using these otoscopes. what are you doing to fix it? Are you looking for training or anything? And then you would get the very embarrassed answers that they weren't actually doing anything to solve the problem.
Okay.
Right. And that's one thing, which is because that strong positive, you know, isn't really a strong positive. You know, if they're another example I came from the NHS is that every time if I go to these hack days, lots of people find us, oh, you do apps. Oh, that's great. Offspring. You know what you need to do? You need to do an ECG trainer, because ECG is the electrocardiograms, is the reading the heart waves and stuff. And doctors find it incredibly hard to actually read these waveforms. And from those, you try to work out what's happening in the heart. And it's just hard, right? It's a hard thing to learn. And yeah. So I'll always get people coming up to me and say, oh, you should make an app for that. That'll be so important. That'll be so amazing. And then I Google and I find that there's 6 or 7 apps already exist that do that exact thing.
Right. Yeah.
So all these people who were saying this is a vitally important problem had not even Googled to try to find a solution.
That's amazing, isn't it? So it's not that important to them if they haven't looked it up on Google and seen that there are solutions out there already.
That's it. So anyone who's actually trying to do stuff, you know, who's trying to fix a problem, then that's great. Then they're actually, I might well buy your thing. If you give your, they've got a mouse problem and they're trying to make their own mouse trap, you sell them a better mouse trap, they'll buy it. Anyway, so that's my thing.
Brilliant. So that is a great process that you've described there. And people obviously love talking with you about it, about their problems. But you're asking the right questions that actually work, that give you the knowledge you need to decide whether to proceed or whether not to proceed. And is there a way of wrapping up an interview so that you're able to stay in touch with the people who you've asked the questions of, so that they become huge advocates for you if you develop your idea? Is this something that you found to be particularly powerful in terms of giving you the sort of ability to go back to them as you develop an idea further and ultimately to get them to be your biggest raving fans, to advocate on your behalf, to get to buy the products themselves and to tell other people about it?
Yes, but it's in two parts, really.
Okay.
Because there's one bit is, are they really a believer? You know, because that's what, everyone's lovely. So they talk to you, they've told you their story and various things, and you've got ideas. You've probably given them a rough hint as the direction you're going in.
Yeah.
And it should never be more than that, just a hint as the kind of thing you're trying to do. But at the end, I know, were they just being polite, or are they really keen on a solution to this idea? And so this does come from the MOM test, where the suggestion came from. And that's to always ask at the end of these conversations for a commitment of some kind, because there's a number of different types of commitments someone can make. Now, of course, it'd be beautiful, but everyone says it, if someone like was prepared to put down money, you know, they said, oh, were you prepared to put down a deposit to buy this or a letter of intent or stuff? They say that. I find that in reality, that rarely happens. You're not, because you're talking to people at a really, really early stage. Yeah. You're not actually at that point. But there are lots of other commitments. And the main ones people have are reputational commitments and time commitments.
Okay.
So if you can ask them, say, is it, do you know anyone else who would be interested in this that I should talk to? Because then you're asking them to make a commitment, because actually if they're prepared to, or could you introduce me to someone?
You know, yes.
So that they've got to put a certain amount of their reputation on the line to do that, which if they believe in what you're doing, they'll happily do. If they they didn't care. They're not a believer. And similarly, or the other ones I do is time, which is, you know, that, I'm going to then, so I'd often say if I'm doing an app, my next stage will be doing storyboarding. I will actually come up with some pictures and basically, I'll storyboard what the app's going to be doing and stuff. I'm saying, is it okay if I come back with you and talk you through these and we discuss them, or maybe we just test them with you to see how you get on? And if they say yes, then that's good. So if someone says yes, I'll introduce you to Bob and Jane and Sarah. Oh, and I'd love to see what you do next. They're obviously a big fan. And also, this whole process generally makes big fans in the first place. In that everyone loves talking about themselves. If you talk at them, you bore them and annoy them. Whereas if someone else is doing lots of talking, they think you are a really interesting person.
Yep.
It's serious, right? You know, like, for instance, in this interview, of course, I'm doing most of the talking. That makes you, Jamie, seem more interesting.
Well, I don't know about that, John, but the interview is about your process, so it is absolutely fascinating, and it's and you're not just describing a process here within the interview, you're demonstrating how it has worked, which I think has brought it to life as well. But I get exactly what you're saying. I mean, the people who are pitching for capital, for investment, for simply pitching customers, pitching people to support their idea, they, as you say, they have a real habit sometimes of talking at people, getting very, very excited about something that they care about, but they haven't listened. So why should anyone else care about their great idea? And as you've described,
Like leap in there, because you talked to them about pitching, and which I'll come back to in a moment, and just that thing there, which is that. On why it's great to get people to tell you stories and talk about themselves is that everyone loves to be listened to. Mm. Lots of people have actually never been asked this stuff. You know, they've been working in a department in a place for ages, and no one's ever asked them what the job's like and what's hard about it and what's great about it. Just people haven't asked them. No. Asked them, and they're just so happy to tell people. They just love that you did. But I want to get back to your pitching point, because I think actually lots of your listeners might be interested, because I had to pitch to get into the Startup Accelerator.
Yes.
And then we had to do lots of training and experience of pitching to investors. They told us some really great stuff, and I think it affects largely selling anything.
Yeah.
The best bit of advice I got, which is that people invest in lines, not dots. So I'll explain that. So every time you meet someone and you have an encounter, you are a dot on a graph of their experience with you.
Right.
The next time they meet you, you form another dot.
Yep.
And it's the lines between those dots is what people invest in. And that's investors, and it's also clients and customers. So actually, also, no one's going to give you money or generally buy for you rarely on the very first time they encounter you or your thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're pitching to, let's see, I'll tell you exactly how I got into the Bethnal Green Ventures, because I think we did it right. Which is that they had open evenings beforehand where you went and, you know, pitched your ideas, but you also got some little bits of free mentoring with their people. And in there, we told them about our idea, but when we talked to them, I actually then said, oh, I told them what our problems were. So I've got these issues. So I've got some users in the United States, but we don't know why they're using it, or we don't really understand our users that well. And then they gave us suggestions of ways we could do and things we could work on. And then when we went back, a month or two later to the big meeting, you know, where they're actually going to see you to get in, I said to them, all right, last time I was here, you said this. This is what I did with that, and here's what we found, and here's where we're at now. It turns out that this was for the Startup Accelerator, but actually it turns out it's true for all investors, is that they're looking to see that you're mentorable, you know, that you listen and that you take action and you proceed. So the fact that I had asked them questions and applied it and I'd come back to say how it worked, that's the kind of thing that impresses investors.
I bet they were so impressed with that. Yeah, such a good piece of advice.
But to tell you, because I got Bethnal Green Ventures does do early stage funding. They allow us to largely explore ideas.
Yeah.
In terms of getting real money from venture capital, that's not quite how it works. They are looking to scale ideas which are already proven. So yeah. The first thing, if you really want to get into the door with the people who are going to give you big money, you need to show them a product, and you need to prove that it is working in some way. It doesn't need to be making money. You just need to show what they call traction, that, you know, you're gaining users and things are doing right, and then they might talk to you. And even then, they won't invest in anything which is good. They'll only invest in things which are going to be extraordinarily special. You know, it might give them a 10 times return on investment.
Right.
And that was actually why I chose to sort of get out of the startup arena and actually just to make products for hospitals. Because I thought, I actually want to make products that work, but none of these are going to, they're not going to be Facebook. You know, they're going to be good products that's going to work well and do things for people, but it's not going to make anyone a millionaire. And that's what I was happy to do. And that's not really the startup world. The startup world is always about trying to win the lottery.
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't where I was. Yeah, I worked that out after trying it for a while.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's been absolutely fascinating and a superb run-through of a process that you've demonstrated works and that many listeners will find incredibly helpful, whether it's researching a business idea, validating a business idea, or how you might approach a startup accelerator program like Bethnal Green Ventures. And there are plenty of other tech for good startup accelerators and other startup accelerators outside of tech too, but those lessons will apply there as well. Brilliant. Now, John, you mentioned something earlier about a period working at Marks & Spencer as well. And you said that a couple of lessons there from working in a large corporate environment might be of interest too. So I just wanted to see if we could return to those and to unpick what you mentioned there.
Certainly. Yes, at Marks & Spencer's, like all big corporations, it has ups and downs. It can has both filled with amazing people, but yet at the same time, the overall structure makes it very hard to change or do anything different. Everyone who's worked in a large corporation has encountered this.
Yeah.
Actually, I really enjoyed Marks & Spencer's. I actually thought it was a really lovely company. Including the fact, sorry, just this is an aside, but as part of your training when you start there, you have to work in store for a week.
Uh-huh, right.
And so I worked at the Marks & Spencer's in Guildford for a week, and I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I thought, if this job paid more, I would do this.
Yeah. You know?
But anyway, great. It was lovely people. Actually, it was quite nice to be there. But anyway, we were in there, and they did what they did a very good job of was doing the user research. What they did a very bad job of was applying it, but I'll explain. So what we'd get, I think I can say this out loud. If you go to Marks & Spencer's and you're last year or two, they're trying to push this idea of a Sparks card on you.
Right.
And no one cares or understands. But yeah, they still keep pushing it. And one of the things I had to do at that point was we were making the Sparks card functionality inside the app.
Yeah.
And so let me tell you how a user testing lab works. And the fact, because I do this now with my apps afterwards, in a far simpler way. So we get people in. And apparently, there's companies you will just get people who meet a demographic.
Yeah.
And they sit in one room with a researcher. And there's a camera just in the room to see them. And also, say, we were testing apps. So there's a little top-down camera on a phone in front of them. And then there'll be a huddle of us next door looking through monitors, listening to what was going on. It was mind-blowing. Because what would happen, as part of the process, the researcher would just ask the person about their life. It would just say, do you use your phone? You know, what kind of apps do you use? You know, where do you shop? You know, other kind of things. What's your experience? You know, what do you care about? Again, they're always all open-ended questions and getting them to tell you things about their life. We next door are furiously writing notes. We've got writing post-notes and slamming them on the wall of all the interesting things we've learned from these people.
Yeah.
And you can't write fast enough. just these people being so fascinating. And they're just telling you their life, but you're just being blown away. And then we get on to, and eventually you'll get on to testing the app. We'll have some screens to show them. And in this case, we would, our graphic designer would have actually made, you know, pictures which looked like the real thing.
Yes.
And then you actually, through various magic, we do things that when people press buttons on the screen, it takes you to show the next picture. So it kind of feels a bit like you're using an app that isn't fully written, but it's really showing you a series of pictures. And the way that the researcher would do this with them, we would just ask them questions, which is to show them the screen and would say, oh, or what do you think this screen does? And then get them to talk, and then maybe set them a challenge by saying, "Oh, yeah, we'd like to buy a pair of trousers and take it to the checkout." And then you just see them do it, and they're not told how to do it; they just see them use your app. And I think I'd heard this before, which is that the reason why they sometimes do this in soundproof environments isn't so that we can't hear the. People under test, so the people under test can't hear the developers screaming, "It's there! It's there! Just click the damn thing!"
Yeah, I can imagine.
And so yeah, I like for me just things I learned say about it, because I really care about user experience. About you're trying to solve a problem. You know, the technology doesn't really matter, other than the point you're trying to solve a problem for a person.
Yeah,
and just seeing just people's experiences, like the ones I find, say about apps and stuff, and about, well, everything about technology. For most people, if they see a button on a screen which they do not understand, they will ignore it. It is as if it does not exist and was never there.
Yeah.
which to most developers is eye opening. The common we find is that there's this thing. In user interface, it's called the hamburger menu. It's you'll often see in user interface, it's three lines, right? And if you use an Android phone, you're very used to it, right? Because that's a standard way to get into the settings, right? If you don't use an Android phone, if say for instance using an iPhone, it's incredibly rare you encounter this. Okay. And so people put lots of their settings and lots of extra functionality behind there. Well, the Android users bang straight in, can find it, can do stuff. The vast majority of people who don't use Android phones, you may as well have not put that button there.
No,
they don't know what it means. They can't understand it. You may as well have not written any of the functionality go behind that.
And yet, the developer might simply assume that you'll understand, you'll know it's there, you'll know why it's there, and what's behind there, what's accessible there.
And what I love about the whole process really is it how it removes arguments. Because when you're trying to make things, you're all discussing stuff. There's all these discussions about should we do this or do that other thing, should we put it here or there, or should it work this way or that way.
Yeah.
Once you actually put it in front of a real person, those arguments just disappear, just poof, they're just gone, right? Because at one point in the M&S app, we had a little search function, a little thing at the top of the screen. It had the magnifying glass in a field to the right that people could search for stuff.
Yeah.
And it was blindly obvious that it was right there at the top of the screen. That's how you search. But, you know, 5 out of 6 people couldn't find it. So it just became just, well, there's no argument about that. You know, just people couldn't find it when you change it. You know, they're just, you know, just, it just removes all argument. You just find out what has to be done and you do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But of course, you know what M&S did? So we did all this fascinating research. We found out what people cared about and what they didn't. And we learned all the loads of stuff. And so, of course, what we find out is we're making the wrong product that, this is not really the way people buy products, and no one cares about Sparks. Mm. And all the sort of stuff. We'd actually find out what they really, really cared about, we find. And what we're doing, well, we're a big corporation, so we ignore all the really good stuff. And all the stuff which was, oh, keep doing what you're doing, but maybe move that thing a bit to the left or make that thing a bit bigger. We did all that stuff. You know, they follow the same path, but differently. We did. You're making their own product, do something else. We ignored. Which is actually why I think that small players have such a massive advantage to the big players, because the big players can't change. If you're actually prepared to say that something is wrong and then do something about it, you have a massive advantage.
You can. You do indeed. Brilliant. Well, John, time flies when you're having fun, and this is fascinating. We've been talking for a little while now. We've got about 5 minutes of the radio show left, so I want to, and I think we're going to leave folk wanting more. I certainly want more, and I'd like to invite you back onto a future program to talk with us again. But in the meantime, I'd like you perhaps to wrap up by telling us where next for you this year. You've described a fascinating journey, and you've given people some wonderful tips on validating, researching their business ideas, applicable to all sorts of businesses, social enterprises and ideas. What are your plans for this year? What will you be looking back on and proud to have achieved when we get to the end of 2018? What's next? What's coming up?
This is the new John Holcroft. Well, what I find, you know, for doing these startup accelerators and doing the things, I realized that I didn't want to follow that path as far as it, even if I succeeded, and it is very hard, you know, that even if you do a great job, trying to do a startup and make a product and have that be your income for the rest of time, it's just a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
You are effectively playing the lottery in that respect. But I find that the stuff that I loved was making products and finding out what mattered to people and then making them. And then moving on and doing another one. I realized I didn't actually want to be at a startup because I would do this great work of making a product once, and then I would have created a job which I didn't really want to do and couldn't resign from.
No.
So what I said is now, actually, what I want to do is to help people make products.
Right. Yeah.
So that, and the process of writing a book on lots of these type of things. So my website is johnholcroft.co.uk.
Yep.
And I'll spell my surname just because lots of people can't get it. That's HOLCROFT.
Right.
So yep. johnholcroft.co.uk. And there I'm trying to do training to help people. It's really based on apps, but it's also product development. And it's like, you know, is that here's how you talk to people. Here's how you test your ideas. Clearly, from my expertise on apps, and what I find from apps is that, you know, 90% of what makes an app succeed and is hard about it is entirely non-technical. And you can entirely find it by talking to people and doing drawings and showing drawings to people. The expensive bit is the coding. And that's the last thing you should do. You should do that after you should already know it works before you've even started doing the coding. Most people don't get that. They just think that you've got to get a... my analogy is it's like getting... Imagine you want a new kitchen.
Yeah.
And you employed a builder and then thought about what kind of kitchen you want. And then said, where should we put the sink? all sort of stuff. You know, you don't do that. That's crazy. You come up with all your plans and your designs. You've done things. And then you get the builders in. And that's similar with coding, and that that's why you can do that.
So you can sketch out an app before you start coding, and you can show it to people. You can test it through the process that you've described before.
Indeed. So what I'm trying to do for people, hopefully, is that by the time this goes live on my website, there'll be an Ask John section. If you have any questions, ask me, and I'll do my best to answer them because I do care about helping people and training people, and I want to understand the struggles that other people have in making products and dealing with technology.
Yeah.
And so I see myself doing a few things, which is both just the training and education. And in some cases, some people, you know, may want for me to do these things for them because it's very well, you can read this stuff and hear tell about it, but actually then when you actually have to go and do it, it can be a bit intimidating.
Yes.
Sometimes you need someone just to hold your hand the first time or so. I think like if you hear people do these user interviews, both the ones before you have a product and things after you've got things to show them, after you've seen it once, it's really obvious and easy.
Yes.
But do you think you have to have seen it once before how obvious it is? It's so simple, it's hard to grasp how simple it is.
Yes, I suppose it is. We have a tendency to overcomplicate. And that is a most excellent note to end on. I'd like to give you the opportunity to give your website and contact details out again just when we finish. But in case we've missed anything, and I think this has been wide-ranging, a robust process, a process that clearly works, a process that people enjoy, the people that you need to know whether they will use your app, use your product. They enjoy this process of research and it works. Is there anything we've missed that you're able to describe in perhaps, I'm going to give you 60 seconds, John, and anything else to add? Because I think this has been fabulously helpful. Is there any further point you want to make?
Yes. Build the simplest thing possible. everyone, and absolutely everyone, gets carried away with their big idea and the big thing, right? You're trying to solve a problem. What's the simplest possible thing you could do? Yes, I know you've got the idea for Mercedes, but you don't start by building a wheel. You start by building a bicycle. and then you learn from that. So always start with the first question. After you've done your user research and you've done your talk to you understand, work out what's the simplest thing that could possibly work. It might well be a piece of paper. And that would still be great.
Excellent. And can you give your contact details, your website address out once more for us, please, John?
Sure. So it's johnholcroft.co.uk. So that's John with an H, J-O-H-N. Holcroft, HOLCROFT.co.uk.
Magnificent. John, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks so much for joining us on the radio show. And listeners, get in touch with John. John Holcroft, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're open for business live.